From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In the first half hour, I talk with Loras College student and Iraq War veteran Jake Kraffel. In 2007, after two tours of combat, Kraffel contemplated suicide as he struggled with the transition to life back in Iowa. His new book, Shadows of War, is a fictional account of war's effects on soldiers and families. Then in our second half hour, State Representative Ray Zirkelbach, chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. He'll tell us about legislative changes to help veterans and military families in the state. That's all coming up after this look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In this hour, we grapple with the legacy of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan once our servicemen and women return home. In our second half hour, State Representative Ray Zirkelbach will join us live. Zirkelbach is chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. He'll tell us about legislative changes to help veterans and military families in the state. First, though, an Iowa combat veteran who has made his voice heard in the state capitol about new legislation for veterans. In 2006, Jacob Lawrence Kraffel was honorably discharged from the United States Army after serving two tours of combat in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Kraffel served 4 years as a paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne Division. His new book, Shadows of War, is a fictional account of war's effects on soldiers and families. He's now a senior at Loras College in Dubuque. Jake Kraffel joins me in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City this afternoon. Good afternoon to you, Jake.
How are you doing, Ben?
Great to have you with us. You had two combat tours of duty in Iraq. What years would those have been?
My first tour started in September 2003, and I came back home March 2004, and we deployed that winter again, December 2004 to March 2005.
After returning to the U.S., you nearly took your own life. You struggled with post-traumatic stress disorder. Tell us what happened after you returned from that second tour, or did these signs, this struggle with this stress, surface before at the end of that second tour?
I didn't really notice anything until I got back home to Iowa, and I was separated from the unit and the men that I was overseas with. When you're in the unit, you have everybody with you. You have your guys that seen what I seen, and I seen what they seen, and we had that bond between us. And when I came home to Iowa and I started living by myself, all I had left was my dog that I had down there, and I felt like I lost that brotherhood, that camaraderie, and even though I know most of the guys are just a phone call away, it just went downhill.
So downhill in terms of depression?
Depression set in. I tried focusing on schoolwork, and which did give me a start into the book. I was started as a project for Jim Brumeyer's composition class at NICC.
NICC is?
Northeast Iowa Community College in Piasta. And it started as a project to get extra points on a portfolio. And that's when I wrote the central part of the book. It was just 40 pages. And that really helped me see what was going on in my head and started getting at some of the issues that were inside of me.
When you were depressed, what were the questions, the thoughts that were troubling you, leading to the depression?
Everything. What am I going to do with myself? I was pretty lost.
What did life here now, returning to Iowa, have no meaning? There was no joy here in your family, in the people you used to know?
I lost really all interest in my family. I didn't want to go to Christmases, Thanksgiving, any holidays. I think that might have been because I was deployed over the holidays so much that it was just another day to me. I didn't want to do anything with my family. I pulled back from most of my friends.
But why? Most of us would think you're back, and you would take a lot of even more joy in that.
I couldn't get some of the things that I'd seen and done overseas out of my head. I seen it everywhere I went. At the 4th of July, the first summer I was back in 2006, I sat there with the fireworks going off. I sat on a bench and cried. I was just completely swamped, overwhelmed with flashbacks. I seen it everywhere where I went. I couldn't listen to some music that I'd heard over some of my favorite songs. So I listened to them when I was overseas, and just hearing that music would throw me back, and I could see what was going on around me. But yet I have this cloud or veil. I could see it literally brought me back. I could see Baghdad again, and I could smell everything and feel everything I felt over there. And I'd get scared. I'd black out for 20 minutes at a time. I'd wake up on the stairs of my house crying.
And the people around you, your loved ones, had no idea, couldn't fathom what you were going through.
They cared. They wanted to help. But I don't know if they knew how.
Jake, you got to the point of contemplating suicide after your return to Iowa. In August of 2007, you even went as far as to write a suicide note that you left on your kitchen table. Tell me what led up to that point, the last days up to that near suicide.
It was constant flashbacks. I couldn't go anywhere. I could hardly do anything. I didn't want to leave my house. My uncle started seeing some of the signs. He had recognized that I was pulling back. He served during Korea. And as far as I know, he never went, but he was trained in soldiers, and he had his own experience in the service. And he had been dealing with some of the things and he's seen it in me. And he did. He called my dad.
What did he see in you? What did he recognize?
He recognized himself 50 years ago and dealing with it. He'd been dealing with his own flashbacks for 50 years, and he wanted to stop me from living through my own 50 years. And he called my dad with the number for the VA, and my dad left me a voicemail because I wasn't answering my phone anymore. And I had everything all planned out, and I was sitting outside the night before I was going to do it, just sitting on my front stoop smoking, chain smoking left and right.
You had it planned out how you were going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
How was that plan?
Like I said, my note was on the kitchen table, and I had one shotgun. It was a 870 Express, and the only friend I thought I had left in the world was my dog Elvis, and my plan was to go outside by the doghouse and sit down.
Any thoughts at that point in the condition that you were at as to the grief that you would have caused in your family?
No. To me, what I had planned was my only way out, my only way to end what was going on.
So the suffering was so great, you just wanted to release yourself.
It hurt. It wasn't like you got hit or something. It was just pain inside. You just wanted it to stop. And I don't know. I guess my dad called me and left a voicemail. And I listened to that voicemail sitting outside, and I called that number down here in Iowa City and asked for psychology and told them what was going on, talked to a nurse, and they said, just hang on. We'll get you through. We'll get you down here tomorrow. Come on down tomorrow. We'll get you in here. Get you some help.
Mm-hmm. Did that nurse say anything on the phone that was a turning point, or did the turning point not happen until you reached help in Iowa City physically?
She talked me back
from
the edge.
How did you do that?
She listened. I told her what was going on, and she just listened to me. She didn't tell me how to get over it. She just listened. She asked me to tell her exactly what was on my mind, what I was thinking and what I was feeling. And it's a blur what I all said to her that night. But she got me back. She talked me back away from that edge.
Is it too painful to tell us a little bit about the most painful images that kept recurring in your mind?
One of the most things that still comes back is we were on patrol in a marketplace. And we parked the trucks, and we were doing some security. And there's crowds of people all around us. And this little girl came out of the crowd, and it's packed in the marketplaces. And I remember this little girl coming out with a grenade, her hand held out towards me, and in her hand was a grenade with no spoon on it. And she was from me to you away, Ben, 3 feet away. And my instinct is to raise the rifle. I centered it on her forehead and switched from safe to semi. And I didn't pull the trigger. I thought if it's going to go off, it's going to go off either way. But if it's not going to go off and she's trying to do something good with it, bring it to us because she trusts us, then I would have just killed the little girl for nothing.
She, when it doesn't have the spoon on it, does that mean if she releases, it's gone?
It was a dud. She had found it.
It was a dud.
And she was bringing it to us because she thought we were the ones who could take care of it. She was trying to help. And that's one thing that always comes back to me.
And what happened in that situation?
I took the grenade from her and I told everyone to get back. And we set it up on some rocks and surrounded it by tape. And we had the engineers come down. We sent a message up to the engineers to come down and dispose of it.
How did you know it was a dud?
It hadn't gone off yet. It was, oh, what do you do in that situation? You back away and just...
What does your training tell you to do in that situation?
Back away, deal with it, figure out how to deal with it, secure the area. You always got to secure the area, get out of the kill zone, do what you have to get everyone out alive. And it was a dud. We just took it and set it down on some rocks, marked it, and the EOD came by later and disposed of it.
How many similar distressing incidents like that would you have gone through in your two tours of duty?
Oh, the mission that my unit had the first tour, it was, some of us describe it as probably one of the most dangerous missions that a regular Army unit can have. Our job was to go up and down Highway 8, the airport highway, Route Irish is what we called it too, and drive back and forth. Our job was to find the roadside bombs. And we'd do sweeps 15 miles an hour just waiting to get looking for them. We'd drive by them 3-4 times sometimes before we noticed them. Oh, I've had to search coffin, make sure there's no bomb in there. RPGs missed our truck by 3 feet. And that was when we didn't have armor on our trucks. It was soft skins.
You lose some buddies?
Fortunately, our unit didn't lose anybody to enemy fire. We had one suicide over there that I remember.
Mm. Are some of your buddies, you're a sergeant, you're a former sergeant, any of them still over there, or are they all back stateside?
As far as I know, the old Charlie battery was disbanded when they realigned, did the base realigning and closure. I'm not sure exactly where they've all scattered to the wind. A lot of us got out when our times were up, others reenlisted in just different jobs. We all scattered to the wind, and we're starting to find each other again online, Facebook.
Jake Kroffel is my guest today, an Iraq war veteran. He had combat tours in Iraq. Now he's a student at Loras College, also the author of a new book, Shadows of War, a fictional account of war's effects on soldiers and families. We'll talk about that when we come back. And also later in the hour, State Representative Ray Zirkelbach of the House Veterans Affairs Committee talk about legislation that we have, some signed, some pending, to help veterans and their military families. We'll be back in just 1 minute. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News today, talking with Jay Kroffel, an Iowan, an Iraq war veteran, served two tours of combat duty in Iraq, in Baghdad. Now a Loras College student, he's the author of Shadows of War, a piece of fiction that he's written, inspired, if you can use that word, by his service in Iraq. Jake, you've recounted up to this point the real-life things, that the dealings that you had here, your near-suicide, one account of what happened in Iraq. How do these traumatic experiences then inspire you to write this book, Shadows of War?
Like I said earlier, it started out as a project, excuse me, for a composition class. And it was about 9 months after I started writing for this class that I got into counseling down here at the VA. And part of that counseling was to write what was in my head, to write down the memories I had, to revisit them and figure out what was hanging me up from getting over them, dealing with them and getting past them, putting them behind me. And I found out I enjoyed writing, and it really helped to get this story out of me.
Had you been journaling while in Iraq or prior to that?
I didn't journal in Iraq. I wrote a lot of letters. In basic training, I kept a journal. Really, other than that, I never really wrote in my free time. But once I started writing and getting it out from what was in my head, then I just kept going.
And that eventually turned into this book. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about the story in Shadows of War. It's a piece of fiction. And then I'd like to ask you to read a short passage. But tell us, broadly speaking, what this work is about.
This work is the story of a soldier who is in combat dealing with undiagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder. And he's a sergeant. He knows his mission is to bring his men home alive one way or another. And his motto is to shoot first, ask questions later. He's always going to do what he can to bring his men home. And that's the story. When he's over there, his mind... He has these flashbacks, and you know he thinks they're just dreams, and he knows something's wrong with him, but he's got to do the mission first. And the story just goes from there, and to when he comes home, and that's his. Yeah.
Your main character is Sergeant Joe Bush, mm-hmm. and the book opens with Joe in Iraq, in Baghdad, where you were. It opens with a flashback on a patrol, and. Can I ask you to read a short passage from that?
Yeah.
This is Joe Bush, Sergeant Joe Bush on patrol.
Joe pinched the smoke between his lips and picked up the lighter. He sucked in the first breath of smoldering air and felt the raw refreshment deep in his lungs as he held his breath in and slowly let it trail out his nose before his mind shattered. Get down, now! The face is blurred like the buildings with hollowed eye sockets for windows and mouths like skeletons. Flashes blinked out of its nose. His men searched for cover on the trash-strewn street. The only available cover was behind a horseless produce cart. The closed mouths of houses that lined both sides of the street watched the eight men frantically dive into the debris. They returned suppressive fire in order to buy time to find better positions. Men in shadows ran across the street in American uniforms while the eyes and noses of abandoned businesses blinked their deadly sparks. Pieces of pavement and corners of shops flew apart in explosions around the squad. Men spoke in voices clearer than the pop and zip of bullets flying all around. One moaned, wounded.
Jake Kroffel is reading from the very beginning of his new book, Shadows of War, a work of fiction. You already talked about needing to write this story for yourself, mm-hmm. as a therapy. You found it was a great therapy. You found that you... delighted in writing, and it helped you in some way. Is also the goal of writing this story, did it become, I can imagine this is tremendously helpful for other vets to hear.
Yeah. That's once I started writing it, I realized that my story could help someone else who is in my same position. I remember when you're on that edge of suicide, you do feel all alone. You're on that edge, and you feel like there is no one else around you and you're by yourself. And I learned that all it takes is for someone to shout out that help is available. Mm-hmm. Sometimes all it takes is for someone in that position to hear a voice in the darkness, to know that they're not alone out there. And that's what I wanted the story to be, is a shout out in the dark to men and women who are in that same position.
Weren't there any services available to you through the U.S. Army, through the VA, that they would look after you and look for this appearing when you came back?
One of the things we learned, when you're coming home, the first initial deployment, I don't really remember any kind of counseling or anything. When we got back home, I was part of a detail. I came home 3 weeks later than the rest of the guys. Came home in the middle of the night and drank myself into oblivion that night. But the second tour, they started screening some. But the questions were so obvious as to which answers you had to pick so as not to get flagged. Because when you're on your way home, the last thing you want to do is get flagged for further counseling. You just want to get home, see your family, and try and get back to life. You've been dealing with the Army for so long, you want a break.
Right, and that speaks to the stigma attached to post-traumatic yes. stress disorder, too. You don't want to flag yourself as having PTSD.
Yeah, there is a stigma attached to it, because it's a wound that doesn't bleed. You can't see it. You can't put a bandage. You can't put a field bandage on it. But yet, it's just as dangerous as a bullet wound.
how much of the culture in the U.S. Army, in the military, is still a suck-it-up culture?
I think they're moving in a better direction, in a good direction now. But it's part of the military, and the culture of it is to be a man, suck it up and get over it. You know? Mm-hmm. But there's times when you got – and there's no shame in admitting that you need help, which is one of the things that my counselor, my therapist down here at the VA said. She asked why I waited so long to get help, and I said it's because there are guys coming home missing an arm or a leg. They need the help more than I do. I got all my arms and legs. What's wrong with me is I can't see it. It's in my head. It's not. I didn't consider it to be a wound. And she said, "You know what?" She said, "I see those guys that are missing arms and legs, and they come in here after waiting so long too." And I said, "Okay." And she goes, "You know what they tell me when I ask them that question?" She goes, "It's because they waited so long because they know there's guys coming home without either arm or either leg, or they lost both arms, both legs. You're always got it. You're always, in the military. You're trained always put." Other men and other women and other soldiers before yourself to take care of your buddy. But eventually, to take care of your buddy, you have to take care of number one. You have to take care of yourself in order to take care of number two.
Was there a moment, a session you had with your therapist that just broke you down?
The first four or five sessions, I broke down and cried just about every time. It's as part of the counseling was to go back into the memories, the flashbacks and thoughts I was having, and explore them and figure out what was keeping me back from moving on. Find that sticking point and look at it again and realize that it's in the past. You're able to go on. And
For you, what was that sticking point? What did you discover?
That I had control over it. That I could move on, that it was time to move on. I'll never forget it.
The little girl with the grenade, mm-hmm. how did you find a way to think about that wouldn't keep recurring in your mind and terrifying you?
She trusted me enough to say it, to bring, she trusted the uniform enough to bring the grenade to us. And young children are innocent. We learned that. We got some of our best intelligence from the kids on the street because you can tell when a kid is lying. And we'd buy cigarettes off. But when that when you have that trust, you realize that if they're trying to help them and help us, maybe I can help other guys.
Okay. We have to take a short break, and then we'll come back. We're talking, I'm talking today with Jake Kraffel. Are you a native of Dubuque?
I grew up about 30 miles west of Dubuque.
Okay, very good. Jake is an Iraq War veteran, spent two tours of combat in Baghdad, exclusively mm-hmm. in Baghdad, right?
Yep.
And he's written a book. He's now back in Iowa, a Loras College student, written a book called Shadows of War. It's a fictional account of war's effects on soldiers and families. It revolves around Sergeant Joe Bush. And if you're listening and you're a veteran of one of the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan or another war, you'd like to tell us about your experience, we'd welcome that. 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number. 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. A little bit later in the hour, Jake is going to hang around. A little bit later in the hour, we'll have State Representative Ray Zirkelbach joining us. Zirkelbach is the chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, talking about legislation that is being enacted to help our servicemen and women returning from these wars. We'll be back in just a few minutes. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're grappling with the legacy of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan once our servicemen and women return home. Joining me this hour, Iraq War veteran and now Loras College student, Jake Kraffel. He's served two tours of combat in Iraq, specifically in Baghdad during both of those tours. He's written a fictional account of the war's effects on soldiers and families titled Shadows of War. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll be joined by State Representative Ray Zirkelbach, the chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, to update us on goings on in Des Moines legislation to help our servicemen and women here. Jake, joining me in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Let's talk, if we could, a little bit more about post-traumatic stress disorder, since part of your mission is coming out and writing this book and talking is to destigmatize this disorder that people have. Tell us a little bit more about the situations that most bothered you coming back that you now know are related to PTSD.
One of my first experiences coming back home, that looking back, I recognize now was a symptom, I was coming up to a gate at Fort Bragg, and there's a thunderstorm brewing, and lightning, there's a big old lightning bolt, and some thunder. It was real, it was close, and it sounded just like an explosion. And right next to the gate, I swerved across three lanes of traffic in my car, trying to bring my car to cover. And I stopped there right outside the gate, and I was like, what the heck just happened? And
why doesn't something tell you that you're not in Iraq anymore, that you're safe and it's just a thunderstorm?
You're so part of the combat experience is you build yourself up to live off of adrenaline, and it's always in your system. And when something is so similar to what happened overseas, your body just takes over. That's how you train yourself, so as you don't think when your body believes you're in danger. It's the fight or flight.
So the thinking part
shuts off,
and it's just the reacting part.
And it's reacting because your body thinks it's in danger, and it's going to get you to cover. And you deal with it later. That was one of the first symptoms. I won't drive over a piece of trash in the road. I've heard a lot of stories, and I know they're true of insurgents placing IEDs inside dead animal carcasses with a pressure switch. So when a convoy drives over a dog or something in the road, that pressure switch is activated and the IED blows up. I'm trash alongside the road, I'll swerve out of the way. And even just on the drive down here, not a big fan of a lot of people standing next to the street. I got nervous even just driving across the University of Iowa campus.
Really?
I knew what was going on in my head, but my body felt nervous. But through the counseling, I learned that how to cope with it. I know you never get over PTSD, but you learn how to cope with it, how to recognize.
Start ignoring some of the signals.
Start ignoring it. Start getting control back. And you learn what's going to happen. You learn triggers, things going up to it that might put you over the edge.
And what is it? Slowly, those sharp reactions get duller.
You start bringing your body back down to a more realistic level, less adrenaline. And
I've spoken with other veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, and they always seem to dread gatherings, crowds, parties, people even laughing, having a good time was something that would set them off.
Yeah, it's the crowd of people, because when you're by yourself, it's easy to take stock of a situation, know your surroundings, know your area, and know the exits. And just basic things that you train yourself to look for in combat. You know, you're always looking for when I walk into a building, even now, I look for possible, you know, what would happen if someone would walk in here with a gun. I know exactly where everything is when I walk in.
You thought that you came into the studio and you thought, what am I going to do if somebody appears in the hallway with a gun?
Yeah. I look for weapons. I've spotted weapons that if someone would come into this studio right now that I could use to defend myself. It was part of my training to look around
Joe Bush, the fictional character in your book, Sergeant Joe Bush, you're a former sergeant in the Army. He had dreams in these flashbacks in the book, but also dreams. And how was your sleep and your dreams affected while suffering the worst times of post-traumatic stress disorder?
I don't think I really slept for about a year. I had a really hard time falling asleep at night. I couldn't. It was bad. And the dreams, that's why I worked the dreams into the book, because some of my dreams were horrible. I'd wake up screaming. I'd wake and sweating. Oh, one of the worst dreams I had, and it was constantly recurring, was that I would get wounded, something would blow up, or I'd get shot, and I'd look down, and I would see my ribs, rib bones sticking out, the white and the meat sticking out through the skin. I'd get shot in the foot, and in my dream I could still move, but I could not, and I knew I was going to die in my dream, but I could not die until I got my men out of that situation. And as soon as I got the men out, as soon as I got my men secure and the situation under control, I'd know I was going to die. And then I'd wake up, and I would wake up, and I would see the blood on my hands. I would, how many times I woke up, and I would lift my T-shirt up and look down just to see my ribs, just to see that everything was still there.
That's what's communicated in this book that you've written, also through the fictitious character, mm-hmm. Sergeant Joe Bush. You were a sergeant, too, and we get the sense that a sergeant carries around with him a lot.
Yes.
A lot. And what you just communicated, that the weight of the responsibility for your men is even more than the responsibility you have to keep yourself alive.
Yes. A sergeant's mission is for his men, never for himself. It's part of our NCO creed that we remember. You always put the men underneath your command before yourself. Always meet the needs of your soldiers.
To what extent is the fictitious Joe Bush like the real J. Kropfel?
There's elements of myself in that character. I'll let that loose.
Why not write a nonfiction version of this book? Why not just write about your two tours of duty? You had to think about that.
Nonfiction, I'm limited to what really happened. But with fiction, I had the freedom to explore different images, different metaphors for the experience. I wanted to find a universal thing. With nonfiction, some people might relate, some of the guys that are in the situation might relate to exactly what happened to me, because my situation was unique. But with fiction, I can try to create I tried to create more of a universal metaphor that everyone, that's elements in the story that everyone, soldiers, their families, their friends, can take from the book and learn from it, take the message.
If you just joined us, my guest is Iowa Iraq War veteran Jake Kropfel, and we want to also ask you, you've taken your experiences, the mm-hmm. things that you've talked about here in this hour, to Des Moines to lobby for veterans and military families.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that start?
I got my name in the Democratic Party with the caucusing for President Obama in 2008. And I just started at a little town of Luxburg, about 100 people at a caucus. And from there, I just kept going up and up and got elected as a national delegate for Obama. Represented him at the Democratic National Conference or Convention in Denver. And that's how I got my name into the Democratic Party, that I was a soldier. Most of my ideas align with the Democratic ideals, but my experiences really spoke for themselves, and then I carried over to they kept my name in the bucket, and when they needed some help to get the message across to work for veterans,
What have been your chief concerns in regards to veterans that we could solve or help remedy with legislation?
This last bill, one of the last bills that they got through with about veterans' health care, specifically mental health care and addiction. I think Ray Zirkelbach will be able to explain more about it. But I was a real fan of getting that one passed, requiring the insurance companies to offer coverage for veterans, that they couldn't kick them off because they developed a mental illness stemming from their service. That's pretty dirty to kick someone off coverage after they serve the country and then they develop issues from it.
Let's welcome now into our conversation State Representative Ray Zirkelbach. Zirkelbach is the chair of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. He joins us now by phone from Monticello, I believe. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Ben. How are you?
Great to have you with us, Ray. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to the conversation, I think, up to this point. Let's talk about this legislation since Jake just mentioned it. At first glance, it appears that the governor has signed or is contemplating signing more legislation than ever for veterans. Can you give us a quick rundown of what's on the docket there?
Well, we had 10 out of 10 priorities that were established by the Department of Defense that will help with current soldiers and their families, and even including extended families, as far as things that would be able to help them immediately. And Iowa is the first state to accomplish this, and I'm very proud of that our legislature worked through it. There were some huge bipartisan battles in the situation, but we maintained and got it wrapped up, and now the Department of Defense is looking at Iowa as the leader and as a model for how we should do things as states nationwide.
Mm-hmm. Specifically, tell us again, where is Iowa at the forefront of? What did Iowa do first that has not been done by other states up to this point?
Well, out of the 10 out of 10 initiatives, we did a number of things that were sporadically spread out across the state, like trailing spouse unemployment coverage for spouses that had to leave their job because their other, you know, their spouse had to go on a deployment. They can't make it. They need to spend time with their family. They need to move with another family member, things like that. We did stuff with remains of bodies, other language requirements as far as allowing our soldiers to get language requirements in the state. There's just a lot of different things, help for incarcerated veterans who are in county jail so they can get immediate assistance so we can shift the burden from the county and the county taxpayer to the federal government. And there's other things that we did this year that were nationwide efforts that have not been done anywhere. A bill allowing veterans to have Veterans Day off. It will be the first in the nation to allow anybody a guaranteed holiday off. So that was kind of a labor/veterans bill, and the mental health parity bill that opened the door for 250,000 veterans to receive mental health and substance abuse treatment on their insurance policies.
Tell us a little more about what Jake mentioned, the denying coverage to veterans who have acquired some mental illness. Is that part of the latest health care reform, or is this something separate?
Well, I can't comment on it. I did not actually hear the conversation. I must have been on mute. But could you fill me in on what Jake was talking about?
Jake, remind us of what you
were mentioning. I was talking about that last bill. I think it might have been called the omnibus or what.
The insurance omnibus bill, yes.
Yeah, that one where they require coverage for veterans with mental health, and so I think it was substance abuse issues.
Yep. What it does is the exact bill. It requires employers, and the impact to employers is less than $5 a year per veteran. We had a huge debate on that on the floor of the House. Some said that was just way too much and people wouldn't hire veterans, and my response to them is, would you really want to work for a business who wouldn't pitch in an extra $5 a year to ensure that the veterans had adequate, you know, mental health and substance abuse treatment? It expands it to 250,000 veterans. It's kind of like how orphanages started. It used to be the war orphans' home is how orphanages started and led to that, you know, quality of life issues for children. Well, this is what we're kind of looking at now is the mental health and substance abuse. We're going to prove that treating these veterans early and often, allowing them access to rural areas, especially where it's critical, where there isn't coverage, will allow veterans to seek treatment right away in a more comfortable setting than the VA and access it immediately to help them through any, you know, acute struggle that they may have, and also for just treatment on down the line.
When controversy did surface in the debates over these bills, Ray Zirkelbach, what did the controversies normally revolve around?
Usually it involved around business versus veterans. That's where the controversy laid. The Republican Party would often side with the businesses, and they would claim that this is just too much of a burden on the businesses, the Veterans Day off, the trailing spouse unemployment, and on the mental health parity, and we're talking about $0 for the veterans' day off. We're talking $5 was the fiscal note a year for the insurance, the mental health and substance abuse coverage. And on the final one, I think the cost associated was $200,000 that came off of the interest on our very, very sound unemployment trust fund that has $450 million in it. So this wasn't any new money that will be contributed to the from a business to cover this. I mean, basically, we got all three of these things done for about $5.
How significant is it to have a veteran like Jake Kroffel, who is knowledgeable with his experience also about the behavioral and mental health issues on the state panels dealing with mental health policy and reforming it?
Oh, it is very, very, very significant. You could have all the experts line up, but nobody but people like Jake could actually tell you what the experience is like, what they go through, you know, what they feel. Jake is a very, very confident, intelligent man who has, you know, vast experience compared to somebody just off the street serving on this. It makes a huge difference for us to have that knowledge on these panels to look at legislation geared towards supporting the public in general and veterans too.
Mm-hmm. So in looking around at the faces on these panels and in discussions afterwards, you know that Jake had an impact.
Yeah, Jake came in and spoke to our Veterans Affairs Committee, and, you know, there are people in tears. I mean, this is straight from his mouth. This is his life that was portrayed and that he told to us. Right then and there, I had that bill, the Veterans Mental Health Parity Bill. I had it in my desk for 3 years. You know, I tried to do it as a standalone bill, and we tossed around some ideas after Jake spoke to us. And I just seen that we couldn't get it done right away. So I thought, you know, the best way to do this would be to get that insurance, the mental health parity coverage on the insurance omnibus bill, and do that. And I seen a hole when Republicans tried to strip all mandates out of the bill, including like breast cancer coverage, checkups for women who are pregnant, everything. They tried to strip that out. I seen, well, there's a germaneness issue here. I think I found the avenue. They ruled theirs germane. I think I can get this in and done. And we got it done. I was very elated.
An email just in from John, who's listening to this program in Oxford. John writes, I have been crying ever since I started listening to your guest. I have PTSD. I have never fought in war, but I have been a firefighter, first responder in Johnson County for nearly 20 years. Mine, I think he's referring to his PTSD, started when I picked up a 4-year-old kid who had burned to death in a trailer. I think about this little burned body every time I hear people like your guest. I never release my emotions in front of other people, but I remember every person I ever worked on, and there were many. I feel now that for every minute I experience something bad, I have to cry or fight or yell out every minute later, or it sticks in me like a cancer. So here we see, Jake, that, you know, people without military service, people dealing with traumatic experiences in civilian life, mm-hmm. can benefit from destigmatizing post-traumatic stress disorder from the words that you have as well.
Yes, sir. If we can get past the stigma and have communities come together and support our men and women in the communities who have seen and dealt with these traumatic instances, and let them know that it's okay to talk to someone about it, to express the emotions and get it off your chest, everyone's life will be better.
Mm-hmm. What can we do? Say you and I, Jake, had met. We'd grown up in the same hometown, and I stayed here. You went off to war, came mm-hmm. back. I see you again. I see that you're changed. If I make your acquaintance, if I'm an old friend getting back in touch with you, how do I know what to do? What advice do you have?
I would say try not to push too hard. If you see someone needs help, sometimes you got to step up and say something, you know, give so-and-so a call, give this number a call. But if you know that they just need to talk, to have someone to listen without judging them, I don't think anybody has a right to judge a veteran for what we had to do and for things we might have been in our mission to do. And just listen. You know, there's help out there.
Ray Zirkelbach, do you happen to be a veteran as well?
Yes, I served on the longest deployment with the 133rd Infantry out of Dubuque. And I'm a Purple Heart recipient and did 2 tours overseas.
Where were you stationed?
I was in the Al-Anbar province of Iraq. Was my long mission.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to deal with any post-traumatic stress?
Yes, I have a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder as well. Mine came from just a bunch of impacts from IEDs and stuff along missions and kind of, you know, similar things that, you know, every veteran may have a different story of how it happens, but there's a lot of things that gear up towards that. A lot of us with anxiety issues that, you know, we're always on guard, you know, that element of PTSD.
What did you find was most effective for you in putting it behind you, as Jake mentioned before?
Well, I don't believe it's ever going to be behind us. It's something that we're going to have to deal with our entire lives. But the thing that really helped me is when my immediate family just started to listen and started to see that, well, he's kind of changed. He's he's a different person than he was when he came home. And it's hard for them to understand those experiences. I came back home to a 17-month-old daughter, and trying to, seeing that you'll fit in as you once were with your, and the 17-month-old daughter, Claire, I hadn't seen her yet, hadn't spent any time with her, and seeing that you try to conform back to society, it's kind of a painful struggle, just to understand, how things are calm, how things are green, just the environment's different.
Mm-hmm.
How things are clean, people take care of each other. There's a sense of community. And coming from a third world country in a war-torn area, that's like, it's hard to plop a veteran down and just say, oh, go out on your own, and here you go, and the VA might be there to help you if you can get in on time.
Ray Zirkelbach, thank you very much. We've run out of time. State Representative, Chair of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, thank you for this conversation. Ray Zirkelbach, joining us from Monticello. And also thanks to Jay Kroffel. He is a former sergeant in the Army, served two combat tours in Baghdad. Shadows of War, his fictional account of war's effects on soldiers and families. Jake, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks to Jake, of course, and Ray for their service as well. The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt, Catherine Perkins, and Alex Hoyer. Our producer assistant today was Christoph Mai. Thanks for joining us.